Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hey, it's Ryan. Welcome to another weekend episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. You know, sometimes you read a book and it hits you in a place that you didn't maybe even know was a place. You know, you read something that's just magical and whimsical, beautiful and moving, whatever it is. It does what art is supposed to do, which is it touches something in what makes us deeply human. And today's episode is about such a book. It's in a way, it's more than a book, and it's about such an author. I'm talking to Charlie Mackesy. He's the author of The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse, which if you haven't read, it doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter if you have kids. It doesn't matter how old your kids are. It's a beautiful book. It's like The Little Prince. It's like a great Pixar movie. It's simple and easy and straightforward, and at the same time, deep on a profound level. It's moving. The drawings are great. It's an awesome book. Elizabeth Gilbert blurbs it. She says, "The world that I am required to inhabit is this one, but the world that I long to inhabit is the one that Charlie Mackesy has created." I would argue that he actually is capturing what the world should be and what the world is when we're pure and young and we've yet to be made cynical, yet to be taught the wrong lessons about life. And this beautiful story about a boy and these sort of friends that he meets along the way, it's what we should be teaching young people, and it's what, as adults, we can't forget. This is a book that has, on Amazon, 74,000 reviews, right? Number one New York Times bestseller, Wall Street Journal bestseller, USA Today bestseller. It's amazing. It'll probably get turned into a movie. It's like Where the Wild Things Are good, The Little Prince good, you know, Pixar's Up good. It's fantastic. And this conversation was awesome. I enjoyed it so much. Charlie was the sweetest guy. I can't wait for you to check this out. Not only should you check out the book, you should also check out his website. If you go to charliemackesy.com, he has a store where you can buy prints from the book, which are incredible. I want this one for my son's room. He has this great page in the book /print that says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And then he says, "Kind." Ah, I love it. It's a sweet, hilarious, amazing book. What is the bravest thing you've ever said? Asked the boy. This is one of my other favorite lines. "Help," said the horse. I don't want to ruin the book, but it's just great. You're going to like this conversation. Go to charliemackesy.com. Also follow him on Instagram, where he has like over a million followers because he posts his awesome drawings, of course. That's at Charlie Mackesy. So here's my interview with the author of The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, and The Horse. And if you're looking for another sort of fable-driven children's book or all ages children's book, I hope you also check out The Boy Who Would Be King. That's my illustrated fable about the young life of Marcus Aurelius, which I took some inspiration from Charlie on. You can check that out at dailystoic.com/king. My son wanted me to start this conversation. He's turning 5 this year, but he wanted me to start by asking you about your dachshund, because we read the page in the book where your dog walks across the page. And so we wanted to know what kind of dog you had. So I looked it up, and we also have a dachshund. So this is his favorite page in the book.
Oh, sweet. He's a miniature long haired dachshund.
We have a miniature short hair. And I love that page too, because it's such a great illustration of it. You almost couldn't have planned it if you wanted to.
Oh, no, exactly. I mean, that's right. Yeah, I could have tried 100 times to get him to do that, and he wouldn't have managed it.
And for people who don't know the page that we're talking about, you say, "The greatest illusion," said the mole, "is that life should be perfect." And then you've got little dog footprints on the bottom of the page because your dog walked across the page.
We did, trying to make the point, clearly.
Yes. That was one great piece of advice I got early on as a writer. My mentor, the writer Robert Green, said, you know, it's all material, it's all fuel. It's this weird thing where you want things to be exactly as you want them to be, but actually it's the things that go wrong that you can, it makes your point better in this case. And I feel like there's a metaphor in that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think you have to be open to it, because you can just see it as a mistake or annoying. But I think if you can see the other side of it, there's often something, you know, better sometimes.
I think that's right. You have to, the Stoics talk about the art of acquiescence, sort of going along with things. And I think that's part of it.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So tell me about the origins of this book, because it's such a beautiful book and it's been this monster hit. And it's weird that it is, I've never read a children's book like it. I mean, the only sort of analog I could think of would be The Little Prince, which is close, but even there, it's sort of more of a direct, it's more, it's sort of half novella, half children's book. How did you come up with this concept for a kid's book, which is, it's loosely a story, but it's also kind of a series of sort of quotes and bits of wisdom tied loosely together.
Firstly, it's not a kid's book. It was actually written with the intention for as much as adults as it is children.
Sure.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I suppose the narrative is the conversation. So I wasn't really looking for, then this happened, because I think narrative can be just conversation. And a journey of understanding rather than events. So really it was just finding the right series of drawings from all the thousands of drawings that were in my studio, and trying to find a sort of a beginning and end to them, in terms of the boy's journey with the mole, and then they meet the fox, and then they meet the horse. So in a way, you know, they just journey together and understanding each other, and that's really the narrative. There are events, but they're not that consequential. they just happen, because that's how life is. But really, I think the main events in life are not events. They're discoveries about yourself, or they're discoveries about each other, or they're a journey into vulnerability or connection through honesty, or those things I think are seismic, and they're often overlooked. I think it's very easy to sort of, you know, it's interesting, because I remember being at school and learning history, and we were given dates of battles as being significant, and I don't think they are. I think that it would have been far more interesting in the history lesson to have found events where people just discovered things about each other, or I know it's a sort of strange thing to say, but for me anyway, at least life's big events went largely unnoticed by it. They were more internal.
I think that's totally right.
Yeah. So that's really what I was doing was, you know, I tried to keep it as simple as possible so a 4-year-old could read it or a 94-year-old could read it and still get different things out of it, but still get something out of it without, you know, overdoing it or overstating or overcomplicating it, and trying to make what I felt was sort of fairly, I suppose, profound things as simple as possible. And, you know, when I was doing it, a lot of people telling me, oh, you must create more narrative. You have to write more. It needs, you know, you can't just do such a, you know, a sparse book. But I like the idea that people can put their own selves in it. They can project themselves into the spaces. They can feel it. They can give it time. You know, like I left blank pages for a reason. They're not just because we couldn't think of anything else to say. It was like, you know, it was like... It's meant to be a restful thing as well, you know. I think we like to hurry through everything these days. And someone said to me that when they got the book, they read it in 10 minutes. And then the next time they read it, it took them a week. And I love that, you know. And they obviously will see things that I never will. And I think I like that. They tell me things. I go, oh, I had no idea, you know, that's what it was saying. And so I find that thrilling, you know, is that you can sort of catalyze people's conversations and catalyze their, you know, journey into themselves and each other. And yeah, it's a long, I don't know what I'm saying really, but I'm just sort of, yeah, it, kids and adults, it's for really.
Well, no, you gave me a lot to respond to, because I would say, I didn't mean to imply that it was just a kid's book. I feel like what's so amazing about it is the same thing that's amazing about a Pixar movie, which is that it operate or Aesop's Fables, which is that they right. operate on two levels, the sort of silly superficial level and the profound sort of, I don't want to say adult level, but the profound moral level. And depending on where you are in life, but then also where you are in that specific moment, yes. you either get it or you don't get it.
Right. Depending on where you are at that time. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, like in a way, you know, and this is in The Little Prince, he says, sometimes it's only with the heart that you can see. There, yeah. I think there's some things that children probably, some of the adult themes that children probably get from your book better than the adults and right. vice versa, because it depends yeah. on how open your heart is, where you are, what your day was like, whether you're really going to get you know, one of these pretty straightforward quotes in the book, it could go right over your head.
And I think it could well do. Or, you know, some people just don't find it interesting or helpful. You know, there's always, I think a lot depends on, I mean, a lot of the emails I get, and I get many these days, are from people who are finding life difficult
yes.
for whatever reason. And it's sort of, it's met them where they're at in some way. And I love that, you know. And oddly, you know, I think if someone had said, right, you know, Charlie, you've got to write a book or make a book that's going to help people in difficulty, I wouldn't have done a book like that. It's really odd. I just felt it was more instinctual, and I just tried to be as honest and straightforward and simple as I could with four characters that I drew. And I didn't engineer to sell books. I didn't try to make it a hit. I didn't envisage it ever being a hit. It was just something that I made from the depths of me to someone out there who might relate to the ideas. And, you know, I'm still shocked when you say it's a hit in America. I have no idea. I mean, obviously people say, and my agent says it's doing well, but it, deep within me, I can't really conceive of that. It's still a shock to me that it's, that people read it in America, you know? And I love that. I'm really profoundly flattered and moved, but, you know, I suppose it was just a book very quietly made in a corner of the world, without any deep sense that it was going to, you know, I hoped that, you know, 300 or 400 people might like it. And when the agent told me that the publisher was going to publish 10,000 of them, I thought that was insane. I just thought, you're completely mad. We're never going to, you know, you're going to have a load of books in storage somewhere waiting, you know, I had no idea. And I guess I'm kind of moved and thrilled that it has met some people some of the time somewhere in a helpful way. And that to me is worth everything. And I'm glad, I'll always be glad I did it on that basis alone, you know?
Yeah, there's an earnestness to the book, which I think, you know, is clearly rooted in the sort of process you were just talking about. I also suspect that what it really did is it served something, and I experienced this. I did a kid's book called it's a fable, but it's called The Boy Who Would Be King, about the sort of the early life of Marcus Aurelius. And what I've found is that, and I found this in my own experiences as a parent of young kids, is that lots of kids' books are very entertaining. Or they're very sort of moralizing, almost propaganda-esque, you know, like anti-racist baby or something. But they're missing the one thing, which is why we read to our kids, which is we want to prepare them for being good people in a complicated world.
Yes. It's interesting you say about preaching, because I don't like being preached at, and I can smell it a mile off when someone's telling me how to be moral or how to.
Yes.
And I suppose it was, I think we discover most things when we share things rather than are told things. Or we're in a shared vulnerability. We learn through pain and through intimacy and understanding each other and daring to be vulnerable and all those things. And, you know, it's sort of, again, you know, I'm not even sure what I did. Like, I'm in this interview with you now, and it's very nice. I'm sitting in a chair and staring at a screen and still don't really understand what happened or how it happened or how, you know, things managed to convene in such a way as, you know, that we sort of made the book and it did what it did. And I'm still mystified by it, to be honest, you know, like really, yeah. Really mystified. It came from the deepest part of me, and I didn't even really understand what I was doing. I had to trust my deepest instinct and sense of what's right, rather than obey any objective sense that, you know, because the moment I started to analyze it, you know, it's a bit like you sink in the water, because you become too analytical, and I it's hard to explain. But
do you believe in the muses? Like, do you feel like art visits itself upon you, or is it something you unearth? Like, as you think about where a book like this or any of your creative work comes from, do you have some sense of that?
I think I do. I mean, I think it comes from like a cocktail of places, and it's very hard to, and probably not necessary to try to put your finger on the root of something or the source of something. But I think we are complex characters made of genes and history and events and time and friendships and experiences and suffering and love and kindness and hope. And all, you know, we're like this cake that's been made of so many different things. And, you know, I think at some point things can combust out of you. And I know for like 2 years, it was just combusting. And all I was doing, I couldn't keep up with it, was just scribbling notes and making drawings and, you know, had thousands. I mean, this is no exaggeration, but I must have 25,000 drawings made in a very short space of time, just every day from morning till night, scribbling away, thinking about these characters, what they suffered, what they hoped for, what do I really fear, what do I really want, what's, you know, all the questions that we all have. And I don't know where that came from. I mean, you could say it's just the human spirit. You could think it's a spiritual journey, or there are various, you know, or it's just a time of life where you are able to see clearly more clearly what you feel about existence. And, you know, fortunately for me, you know, I'm not a great techie person, but I did share the drawings on Instagram, and I found that immensely rewarding and helpful because they journeyed with me on it. And I didn't have that many followers at the time. And I'd post a drawing and really study their responses and engage with them about what they felt. And so I think it was a collective muse. I would say that it was a wide source of obviously pinpointing me doing the drawings and make and sort of catalyzing things. But, you know, it's so many people helped with the journey. And I'm fascinated by, you know, the detours I took because of a response or lack of response to a certain way of, to a certain drawing. And I said, no, I think that's it. And so in a way, you know, I whenever I see the book and I see my name on it, as the name of my name, I think, well, it's not strictly true, is it? Because, you know, your close friends and lots of people I probably never meet helped to forge this book. And so, you know, I don't feel like I was this lone person in a garret somewhere chiseling away and then leapt out of the door saying, here it is. I think it was. You know, I sort of feel like we all did it, and you know, it's ongoing because the drawings are still coming out and we're still discussing them. So, I'm forever grateful to many people for it.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Elizabeth Gilbert, who blurbed your book, she talks about that idea of the big magic. I think that's what she calls it. And there is something like I had this idea for The Boy Who Would Be King. I'd thought about it for a long time and sort of vaguely knew what I would do, but I had no sense when or how. And it was sometime in the beginning of the pandemic where it just became very clear to me that it was the time. No one said it was the time. I didn't consciously decide it was the time, but somehow, like a cicada, you know, sort of emerging from 17 years underground, it just happens and nobody knows why. And I think there is something magical about all books, but your book, it sounds like you're sort of marveling at the magic where you're like, I don't quite know where this came from. I'm happy to put my name on it, but you know that it was something bigger than you.
You do. It's interesting about The Boy Who Would Be King. I mean, I'm fascinated by other people's experiences of it, you know, or the process or how it happens. And I love the fact that you had no real objective, you know, just the time was right because it because it was. I know for me during that year, 2019, of making, actually putting the book together, that for quite a while, because life was very difficult for me that year for various reasons, I kept thinking, oh, do I have the energy to do this? Can we just not delay it for a year? And that's the deeper part of me was feeling, no, you have to do it now. Like, you have to do it this year. It has to be this year. And so it came out in October that year before the pandemic hit. And you know, the timing, I suppose, for some people who it helped was right, you know.
Totally.
But I, you know, of course, I didn't think it was going to do what it did. And I'm still amazed. And, you know, I didn't think it would go to America. So really, it's a, yeah, I observe it wryly from on the edge of things, looking on at the thing. It has a life of its own. And of course, you know, as with you, you make a book and you won't meet the people, the majority of people who read it and read it, you'll never meet ever. And it's a strange idea, I suppose, to know, yes, that you're communicating with people. It's the only communication you'll actually ever have with them. And part of me feels sad because I like talking to people and I would like to meet every single person who's read it. But in the same breath, it's lovely that even when you're underground, it will carry on speaking. And I think that's a great thing.
Well, in the case of your book, it's such an intimate relationship you're having with the reader, right? It's not like you wrote a technical manual or you know, an analysis of tax policy. You know, it's touching people in a soft place.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, it took a while for the onion rings to come off to be able to find a way of doing that, I think. And, you know, if it has done that, then I'm surprised and amazed and grateful, you know.
So one of my favorite themes in the book is you talk about kindness over and over again, but you talk about it in sort of two senses of the word, which I think we overlook. You know, obviously there's kindness to others. Seneca talks about how every person we meet is an opportunity for kindness, but then he also talks about kindness to oneself. He says, how do I know I'm making progress? It's because I've become a better friend to myself.
Beautiful.
It strikes me that the characters in your book are on that exact journey, kindness to others, but also to stop whipping themselves or feeling bad about themselves.
Yeah. I mean, there's the inner critic, isn't there? Who is ruthless. And, you know, there are plenty of critics out there. Don't be of you or you and I, but just best not be one of them, you know? And I think that's right. I think, and being kind to yourself and, you know, forgiving yourself and being generous to yourself, all those things I think are very, very difficult. At least some people, I know I have found that to be so. And, you know, I think that journey into self-care and self-love is then obviously a big stepping stone into caring for others and loving others, and making that connection took me a long time. The cherishing of self helps you cherish another. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the kindness is a, you know, the word kind I find fascinating, and it's often seen as a sort of fairly, you know, obvious basic word, but it's huge and deep and has all kinds of manifestations.
To go to your point about history earlier, it is striking, right? Like we obsess over the dates of history. We also that's sort of one school of thought, the sort of literal history. Then there's kind of the propaganda history, you know, the patriotic take. And then today we also have this like other school of history, which is like, how can we show that everyone was a horrible hypocrite, that they were awful, that, you know, they mercilessly did X, Y, and Z. It strikes me as such a lost opportunity. I've talked to so many great authors over the years who have like sort of fallen in love with this character, that character from history, like good people. I think that what there is in your book and maybe why it's resonated with people who are trying to sort of raise the next generation is like, you want to inculcate these lessons. Like you want to teach them and inspire them about kindness and being helpful and believing in yourself. And if we're not going to learn that from history, where are we going to get that? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Well, in the way history is taught, we're not going to get it from history, are we?
Right.
I mean, I suppose as you get older, you sort of see people who, I've got friends who've made fortunes and friends who've, you're not. And yet, oddly, now I see the most successful people that I know sometimes have made very little money, but they've been hugely successful with their friendships and their relationships and how they've lived their lives. That has nothing to do with what society would call success. So, for instance, when the boy says, "What do you think success is?" the mole says, "To love." And I, you know, it's that kind of trying to find a way of explaining that in the simplest way possible. So, if you don't feel successful because you haven't earned a fortune, or you don't have a great house or a decent car, then you can think to yourself, "Well, hang on a second, let's look at success in a different way." And you know, I suppose, you know, I was raised. I had an interesting upbringing because I was brought up, you know, with a sort of, you know, in a lovely family, but they were quite, you know, middle to upper class. And I was in a community in a farming community where I would, you know, worked alongside a lot of shepherds who made hardly any money at all, and were sort of lived in the wilds and just had 30 sheep and, you know, lived in, and yet to me they were the most successful people I'd ever met. Because they were happy, and were loved well, and yet had nothing. And I I've always held this truth in me, you know, and sort of viewed the world of obsession with material success as in a sort of fairly cynical way. I think I don't think that's right. And if you know, there's nothing wrong with making money. There's nothing wrong with being successful materially, but it certainly isn't the only form of success there is. And if we can teach that, I think it's a good thing.
Well, that ties into the other lesson of the book, which I think is probably why so few people feel they have that success or feel that love, which is sort of comparison being the thief of joy.
Oh, really true. That it truly is. I mean, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And it's very hard not to.
It's hard as an author too, right? Because you're like, who's ranking higher than me? Who sold more copies than me? Who gets more attention than me? And anytime you can see how other people are doing, it's hard to be happy with what you have.
Right. And rankings and listings, you want to avoid those. I mean, you're right. I mean, the moment you start, if someone has sold more books than you, it doesn't mean they're more successful as a book. It just doesn't.
That's why I always appreciate people like you're doing, where they're sort of like, look, I didn't expect it to be this way. It just happened. Because, you know, it's so easy, you know, talk about telling stories. It's so easy as you become successful to tell a very clear story in retrospect about how you intended this, or you did X and that caused Y. And so that can be so intimidating for people who are just starting, who don't realize that actually you fell ass backwards into it. And you're just making up this story afterwards, so you feel like you deserve it.
Well,
and now they feel like they don't deserve it.
I'm very, very aware of that tendency to rewrite history or make it look a little bit, you know, more intended in this respect. And for me, it was definitely an accident, you know, and it came from a subconscious place that I just, a bit like Forrest Gump, I just didn't stop running. I just kept doing it in a mad sort of state without really knowing what I was doing. And I knew deep down that I was completely winging it. And I knew, you know, deep down that perhaps everybody was ultimately. And I kept thinking, well, if they did it, then why can't I? And if I can do it, then why can't anyone? It's just a question of, you know, believing it and persevering and being as honest as you possibly can and not giving up. And, you know, and being trying to be true. And, you know, I look back now and there's absolutely no way that I have any clue about how it happened or, you know, any of the things. People ask me, you know, I get emails of people asking for advice, and I try to say, well, you know, don't give up. And, you know, I'm not entirely sure how it happens, but I know for a fact that I didn't think I could do it. And I'm not sure if I could again. You know, it's just one of those things you wrestle with and believe in. And yeah, so yeah, I don't, I, there's no, there's, I am, it's a total mystery to me.
One, and that's one of my favorite parts of the book is where you talk about sort of asking for help, right. Which, you know, you talk about endurance and you talk about perseverance. I think sometimes people think that those two things are at odds with asking for help or admitting that you don't know what you're doing.
Right. Well, as though asking for help is somehow giving up, you know? No, I think endurance is great and all those fine things, but I think the help thing was quite seminal really for me, because I remember, you know, when I was in a very dark place and all my instincts were to pretend I was all right and to you know, keep the show on the road of life, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And to you know, it was terrifying to me to ask for help because it was going to be some kind of failure. And then I had to, and it was, you know, it was, I was terrified. But in the end, it was the best decision I ever made. But at the time, it felt weak. And yeah, I think it's ultimately now in retrospect, it was a huge strength to recognize my weakness and to speak from that place is a strength. But we're not taught that. Society, well, here, I don't know about where you are, but certainly here, you know, that idea is, especially as a man, is not a strength, but I think it truly is.
Yeah, well, with what I write about, you know, people confuse sort of uppercase stoicism and lowercase stoicism, where, you know, the sort of the stiff upper lip of the, you know, the sort of British model.
Yeah. But
I think one of the most beautiful lines in Marcus Aurelius's memoirs or his meditations, where he says, we're soldiers storming a wall. If you fall and you have to reach up and ask a comrade for help, he says, so what? You know, yeah. Like it's an act of cowardice not to ask to be pulled back up into the frame.
That's brilliant. I love that. If he said that, then I love him. I mean, he's absolutely right. So what is the point? So what? You know, yeah. If your aim is to get over the wall, if it takes asking for help, then ask for help, right?
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Yeah, and I, you know, in your book, it's the different people can do different things, right? The mole chews the fox out of the trap because the fox can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. And then the mole, and then half an hour later, the mole is drowning.
Yes, we can help each other in different ways.
Well, we carry each other at different times for different reasons. Yeah, and we're sometimes when we're strong, someone isn't, and vice versa. You know, and I think that's the sort of the rebalancing of life. I love that. You know,
my other favorite part of the book is sort of towards the end. It strikes me again, this sort of masculine idea of, you know, being unable to express yourself, say what you feel, you know,
oh, the where, mom. Yeah.
Where he says, sometimes I want to say that I love you, but I can't. So I just say, I'm glad we're all together. That strikes me as something that fathers in particular have sort of wrestled with for all time. They want to say how much all these people mean to them. Yeah. They can't quite bring themselves to do it. So instead they start an argument, or instead they tease, or, you know, they do everything but say what they actually feel.
Yeah, because it's awkward.
Yes.
And also I think, you know, sometimes, you know, there are so many different ways of saying I love you or expressing it. And I know, you know, the mole is very English, actually, I think. Of all the characters, the mole is probably the most English.
With all the cake and everything.
Yeah, cake obsessed. But also, you know, I think the cake is definitely the mole's way of dealing with the difficulties of life. And because he struggles to express himself, he's the addictive part of me. He's the part of me that reaches for cake when life gets tough, until he discovers a hug and says, I've discovered something better than cake. And the boy says, no, you haven't. He says, I have. You know, and the boy says, what is it? So a hug, it lasts longer. So I think for the mole, he's definitely, struggles most, even though he's quite expressive, but about cake, he underneath it, you know, there's all kinds of things going on, like all of us.
Yeah.
And so, right. So there's always a deeper narrative that's trying to speak through that, you know, and that's the same for all of us. You know, I know I struggle saying that kind of thing a lot. And so I, you know, write a letter instead, or I hug someone, or when we're allowed to, or
you buy a gift.
Sure. I normally send drawings to people. There are various ways of saying I love you without saying I love you.
Well, yeah, I mean, even just that idea, I forget the exact title of the book. It's the five love languages. Even the idea that there are different languages of love is itself a huge breakthrough.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And often the words I love you are pretty easy to say. If you're that kind of person, if you're not that kind of person and you say it rarely, it has huge meaning, but sometimes it can roll off the tongue and it's easier than, you know, many things. So I think each person is different with the love language. And
yeah, or you see someone who's so closed off, they can't tell people what they mean to them. And then they're just like, they've just got their dog has them like wrapped around their finger. This is like the most expressive person in the world when it comes to their dog. But
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think we are, I think, depending on our history and culture and genes and the way we were brought up and, you know, all those things influence how connected we are and how able we are to connect with others. And that journey of connection with self and each other is a huge one. And, you know, I sometimes, you know, people write to me and saying the books help them to do that in various ways. And I just feel really privileged to have been sort of, albeit indirectly, part of that journey into connection, you know. And I think, I hear people where the friends or family will talk about a page, or they'll screenshot or photo of a page and they'll discuss it. And they'll talk about, you know, the fact that they struggle to, you know, say, I love you.
Yeah.
And it helps them say, this is what I'm like. This is how I struggle. So you know, I would like to say I love you, but instead I say, you know, do you want pizza? Or, you know, it's all these hidden languages we have. And, you know, that in a way that I'll always, when I hear, well, I read letters where people have told me that, you know, there was one email I had from a guy recently who said that his father is 90 and he has dementia and doesn't know who he is. And his son would come to the home where his father was. There were three generations. And the only thing they had in common was that his father, the 90-year-old, had the book and would stare at the book. And so they'd read, all three of them would read the book together and connect together with the book, even though the father had no idea who his son or grandson was. but that they were connecting somewhere, somehow, deep down, somewhere in the deep rivers of who they were. That's and of course, when I read that, I just cried like a child, or cried like a person, or cried like someone who's crying. I mean, I was like, I was overwhelmed by the privilege of that, that I could have helped in that in some way, in that agonized situation.
Well, don't you think that's what art is, right? It's so someone can go, this is how I feel. Like the artist starts that way, but then the reason the art spreads and has sort of resonance is because it, in touching the specific, it touches the general, or it touches a large portion of the population who goes, this captures an emotion, a moment, a fear, a worry, a whatever inside me, and I can now connect with another person through it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
What is this idea of home in the book, right? If I'm trying to think of the one sort of the plot of the book or the progression, it's that they're somewhere and they're trying to get home. What does home mean to you exactly?
It's a really good question, and I'm not certain myself, but I think it's something that we have a sort of an instinct for. And you know, home is a strange word because it could just mean a house with windows and a chimney and a front door, but I think it's not that. It's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of a deep sense of connection. And I like the concept, and I like the idea that it's not a place. I like the idea that it's, you know, the boy says home isn't always a place, is it? Because I think actually, you know, like in the book, he's definitely lost. You know, he says, sometimes I feel lost. There's a lostness in the boy. Like I think there is in all of us. And it's a physical one and a emotional one and a spiritual one. It's lots of things combined, and I think there's always that search in us wanting home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also I've found that places can evoke feelings. So like when I go back to where I went to college, or and I know you mentioned this in your bio, I lived in New Orleans for a couple of years. I don't have a place there. I don't have any family there. I have some friends still there. But when I go and I walk on the neutral ground, or I walk through through Audubon Park, it evokes, it brings me back to who I was and what was going on and where I was as a writer at that time. And it fills me with a sense of feeling and emotion and nostalgia that I can't get anywhere else.
Right.
So my last question for you was about this idea of enough, which you talk about a little bit in the book. And I wonder, with the extraordinary success of the book too, have you thought more about that idea? You know, people seem to think that if they just accomplish X, Y, or Z, or if they just win this or that, then they'll feel good.
Yeah. Oh, they'll just get a few more likes on Instagram.
Yes. Yes. If I just get verified, if I just get profiled in the New York Times, if I just, you know, I love when you talk to people and they have a number, you know, like a certain amount of money, and then they can retire or whatever. You know, there's that sort of conditional happiness.
Yes. I mean, it's the human condition though, isn't it? We all feel if we were just a bit richer, a bit thinner, a bit stronger, a bit better looking. And I think a real achievement is contentment, is to not feel that ever exhausting, continued desire for something more that would make us complete. I think when you realize you are complete and you are enough, and you can manage to silence the voice in your head telling you that you're not, or society telling you you're not, or your father or your mother or whoever it is that's, you know, influencing you to sense that if you just did a little bit more, earned a bit more, you'd be more attractive or more lovable or whatever it is that we feel we're not, you know. is to just take a deep breath and really sit in your own skin and think I'm, you know, it may be cliche, but I'm loved and I'm enough and I'm a beautiful person, and say well done to yourself rather than saying, come on, you haven't done enough, or whatever it is that the mantra in your head or the tapes you listen to in your head that tell you that, you know, it's to silence them. That, you know what? No, it's a great moment when the things that you think will satisfy you, when you suddenly realize they don't, and those things were never designed to in the first place. They're like slave masters almost.
I read a book by this journalist in Texas who developed a friendship with Mr. Rogers over the years. And it was the book was titled I'm Proud of You, because they would write these letters back and forth. And Mr. Rogers sensed that this guy was motivated by, I think, his father or, you know, some career drive to do or be or whatever. And he just started signing his letters first with I'm proud of you, and then I P O Y, like I'm proud of you. He would just write this over and over again to the Mr. Rogers would write this in the letters to this guy, so this guy could get this sense, you know, that he could feel that thing that he thought he could chase, but he really had all along. And I think, yeah, there is the idea of the characters sort of realizing that they're enough and that having each other is enough. I mean, if you can get that as a kid, oh man.
Well, then you're set.
Yeah.
You are set. I mean, I remember being, like, I used to work for a while with a homeless charity. And now and again, you know, I'd go into some quite difficult areas of London and rough areas of London. And I remember being in a housing estate once, and I met this family, and clearly they had very little, and they lived in, you know, but I remember thinking to myself when I was talking to them, a sense of almost envy that they were really content with their lot. Like, you know, they lived in a pretty, I can't describe, but you can imagine, you know, and, yeah. You know, that they definitely had nothing again, but they were content. And I thought, well, that's wealth right there. And they were happy. They laughed easily and loved each other well. And they didn't have that, clearly have that voice in them going, oh, well, clearly, you know, I mean, you have no right to be happy because look what you have or what you don't have. And there's a beauty in that sense of enoughness that is quite rare, I think.
Do you know the story about Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut?
No, I love Kurt Vonnegut. Oh, my gosh. No, I don't. Tell me.
Vonnegut wrote a little poem about it, but apparently he was at a party with Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch 22. And you know, as a writer, you have this weird experience where even as a successful writer, you're in a sort of certain socioeconomic category, unless, you know, your name is J.K. Rowling or something. But you get invited to these fancy parties because people sort of want to show off their association, right? You're sort of like party favors or something, a status symbol for rich people. And so they're at this party of this billionaire outside of New York, and Vonnegut is teasing Joseph Heller. And he says, you know, how does it feel to know that this guy made more money this week than your books will make in your entire lifetime? and Heller says, but I have something he'll never have. And Vonnegut says, what could that possibly be? And he says, I know what enough is.
Oh,
pretty good, right?
I really love that. Yeah, I know what enough is spectacular. That's, yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Love that. And it's not like, and I, what I love about that story is, you know, this was, I forget when exactly this was, but, you know, Heller writes Catch 22, and sure, he never recreates that success because how many people can write more than one generational defining book? But it's not like he sat around on his ass his whole life. He still did stuff. He just wrote from a place of fullness rather than craving. But that's hard. It's hard to get there.
I think it is for many reasons. Yeah, but I think it's a huge accomplishment. It's a great discovery and a huge achievement.
It's certainly more rare than people who continued, you know, in a way, Tom Brady, you know, winning all these Super Bowls, that's actually less rare than somebody just being content with who they are.
Well, you know, I was once years ago, I'm not a gambler and I don't really like gambling, but I was invited out to some dinner and it was at a quite a smart sort of casino in London. And I'd never been to one, and I certainly, it's not my thing, but there was an Irish friend of mine who'd never been to one either. And and he did the roulette table or something, and he earned £2,000 just by accident. And he just went home with it and never gambled again. Was perfectly happy with that. And it was a magnificent response, which was, he was there, he did it, and he won, you know, which was quite a lot of money then. And didn't feel, oh gosh, well, I could make more. There wasn't this hankering for more. He thought, that was great. And off you went. And I admired that so deeply somehow.
Yeah, that'll be the struggle for you, having sort of hit the lottery on this book. I don't mean financially, it's just you have a one in a million sort of viral word of mouth, accomplished everything a book can accomplish, accomplishment with this book. How do you think about staying sort of true and content and happy as you continue as an artist? Or do you just not think about it at all?
I don't think about it too much. And success has its own difficulties. And I quite enjoy a simple life, an uncluttered life. So I don't hanker to do it again. And I feel genuinely grateful that, you know, we did something that has helped people. And because I didn't intend the first one to be a success, I don't think I'll really try and make the next one a success either. I'll just be surprised if it is. Whatever fame is, I did a drawing recently of the boy saying, what do you think of fame? And the horse just said, who's he? because I do think it's completely meaningless and quite unhealthy. But that said, if you can, you know, use it for good, then I think that's great. I mean, I know, we did a T-shirt. I've done some T-shirts the last couple of years for a friend who runs a charity called Comic Relief and Red Nose Day. It's in America now, but, you know, that charity sort of funds, you know, hundreds if not thousands of projects all over the world, helping with anything from child mental health to poverty to education, all those things. And we sort of did a T-shirt that I drew the boy and the mole on a T-shirt, and it said "Love Wins." They're sitting on a heart, and it made £2 million in, I think, 12 days. And for them, for the charity. So, yeah. You know, for me, if you can use success as a sort of platform from which to, you know, do things, that's great. But otherwise, I think it becomes it's quite destructive. And, you know, I'm just a very kind of scruffy, ordinary individual with dirty fingernails drawing in pictures in a barn. And I like that. And I don't really feel the need to be anything more or different to that. And I mean, I'm just trying to be as honest as I can. You know, so on one level, I'm deeply thrilled to, for instance, be speaking to you, and it's being listened to by people in Texas or wherever they are there. And I'm loving the fact you're listening, and that's wonderful. And that's a surprise, but it's not something that I ever sort of tried to conspire, and it's not something that I ever dreamt would happen. And it's, in a way, it's a strange experience.
And the saddest thing in the world, and it happens a lot, is if success at a chosen thing deprives you of the ability to do that thing, either because you become distracted and too busy, or because now you've sucked the joy out of it with expectations or entitlements or whatever.
Right. Yeah, you know, you're right. I think it can destroy the very thing you enjoy.
What success is that? Or what kind of success is that if it deprives you of the thing or the people that you were doing it for to begin with?
Right. Yeah. No, completely. I mean, I think you're right. I think, you know, it can cloud your view of the how you used to see things, which made you able to do the thing in the first place, for instance.
Yes.
It can elevate you or make you feel more important, you know, self-important, and therefore it can make you proud and therefore then kill the purity of the instinct you had to make what you did or whatever it is.
Or just steal all your time. I was reading a biography of Ralph Ellison. Yeah. It's like he spent the last third of his life, you know, on panels and teaching and, you know, doing everything but, you know, writing another novel.
Well, there you go. I mean, I am, you know, one of the interesting things about this is that we're making an animated film, and that takes up huge amounts of time in a day.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't have been doing had I not made the book. So I'm glad we're doing that. So
sure.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, there are so many kind of pitfalls around success. And I think keep your head down, keep low, remember where you came from, enjoy the simple things in life, cherish your friends, you know,
look after yourself.
Have some cake. Don't see yourself any differently. Recognize that you winged it and you're still winging it. And, you know, and it's funny and you're enough, and be grateful, you know, and also be grateful that if you help someone, that's the best thing you could wish for. And yeah, just remember that you're made of clay.
And that you'll soon be ashes and dust, as the Stoics say.
You certainly will. And pride is a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Charlie, thank you so much. This was beautiful. And thank you for the book. So many memories for us and our family about it. It really is a beautiful piece of work. And it was an honor to get to talk to you.
You know, I mean, please say hello to your family and you know, Ryan, you're great at chatting. It's nice to have spoken to you.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. I'll send you a copy of The Boy Who Would Be King. I'll get your address.
I would be thrilled to read it.
And you sell prints on your website, right? I was seeing this. I want to get some of these prints. They look amazing.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I'm sure we can send you some, you know. Well, you know, let's chat later or to...
Okay.
But thank you. And I, you know, I hope your shop goes from strength to strength, you know.
Yeah, no, it's we sell The Boy Who Would Be King at the bookstore and people love it. And yeah, it's been amazing. It's so cool. You watch, you know, mostly obviously it's the little kids that come in. We have a treehouse in the back and they climb the treehouse and they grab one of your books and they just, you know, it's just amazing to see kids reading. And when they do read something amazing, they immediately forget about phones and television and all that stuff, because reading does touch something very deep in us.
Right. Oh, that's lovely.
Charlie, thank you so much. I won't take up any more of your time.
No. I'm grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Amazing. All right. Well, I hit stop here. Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it,
T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to the best one yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to the best one yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.